Thank you very much, Anthony, and thank you to all of you for attending my lecture tonight. This is actually my first public academic lecture in this country at all, so I'm very, very excited. I think I have about an hour for the presentation and then half an hour for questions. I'm looking forward to the questions and don't want to get into that time, which means that I have to make the most of an hour and the 120 slides that I've put together for tonight. So I'm going to just get right into it. My name is Benjamin Boaz. I am presenting about what is known as Cool Japan. And I have the somewhat unique title of Cool Japan Ambassador, which was a title granted to me 3 years ago by the Cabinet Secretariat Division of the Japanese government, which is ostensibly the part of the central government that coordinates all of the other ministries. As to what Cool Japan ambassadors do, it's somewhat of a case-by-case matter. But in my case, I like to think of myself as someone who helps bridge the gap between Japan and the rest of the world. I work with certain aspects of the government that are within the Cool Japan conglomerate, so to speak. I give presentations about the phenomenon that is commonly referred to as Cool Japan. That's what's happening right now. I also make appearances in media. Here I am on NHK World, the international branch of Japan's public broadcaster, and over there on the left, I am giving a presentation about my book. The Cool Japan Ambassador work is not actually my day job. I feel like in reality I am just a writer. I have put out these two books, as Anthony was kind enough to say. I've also edited Japanese-English dictionaries for my publisher, and have done some work for American companies that are interested in my popular culture expertise. Working is not all I do in Japan, though. I also like to get into Japanese culture. Here I am doing martial arts, hanging out with some monks. This is the game of Mahjong, which is a wonderful game. And over here I am spinning a metal ring on an umbrella. I also have the privilege of being the tourism ambassador for Nakano, the best ward in all of Tokyo, filled with lots of cool stuff. One of the privileges of being the tourism ambassador is that in my meetings with central government bureaucrats, I get to wear the sash and feel a little bit like Miss America. So that was a little bit of what I hope was a delightful introduction to kind of what I am and kind of what Cool Japan is. But it's a relatively confusing subject to talk about because when you just say the words Cool Japan, in English or Japanese, so Cool Japan or Kuru Japan, it's impossible to tell exactly what anyone is talking about. In my personal experience, by and large, people are referring to three different things. Official government initiatives under the Cool Japan umbrella, such as, say, the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry's Cool Japan-branded initiatives. But there's also private enterprises that use Cool Japan as branding. So a private company that says, here is our Cool Japan exhibit, or an amusement park in Japan that says, this is our Cool Japan center. These are not government initiatives, so these are different things. Finally, there's the underlying phenomenon of unexpected foreign appeal, which is by and large what Kuru Japan means in Japanese. I draw the distinction right here because even though I think that most of the time Cool Japan is referring to the phenomenon, oftentimes people will use it to refer strictly to programs that use it in their name, which can make for confusing situations because then the phenomenon gets conflated with programs and branding that are about the phenomenon. And it's this conflation that I think makes up the crux of my lecture. I also wanted to use this slide to take the opportunity that I am here in my personal capacity first and foremost. I am a Cool Japan ambassador. I have lived in Japan for a dozen years, but I don't speak for the Japanese government. I don't consider myself anything of an expert on Japanese bureaucratic practice. I'm actually very interested to hear your views later on. In addition to being the Asian Research Center, this is also the Asian American Research Center. I make no claim to be an expert at all on anything Asian American. This is something that's entirely ancillary to what I think I know a little bit about. But if anyone here has perspectives on what the Asian American take on certain things are, I would love to hear that. Moving on. Righto. What's cool? What's cool about Japan? Presumably, Cool Japan is about what's cool about Japan, but it's a little bit of tricky of a concept to pin down because cool is, of course, an inherently subjective concept. So here we have two very, very popular tourism destinations in Tokyo. Akihabara on the right, Asakusa on the left. They're relatively close to each other, but they tend to attract different people because different people are interested in different things. I mean, by and large, it's traditional culture and modern culture. It's, of course, not quite as simple as that, but it's just to say someone who wants to go here might not necessarily want to go there. Cool Japan as a term probably originated in 2002 out of an essay in Foreign Policy magazine written by Douglas McRae, whose name isn't spelled like that. It's just the screenshot that I took. Went to Brown University and wrote an essay called Japan's Gross National Cool, which then presumably Japanese bureaucrats took, combined with the UK's branding of Cool Britannica, and then combined to form Cool Japan. The underlying phenomenon that the word refers to is, in most conversations that I've been a part of, centered on the boom in foreign interest in Japanese popular culture around the turn of the millennium. Here we have the cover of Time magazine in 2003 with Pokemon on the cover. This surprised some people at the time, as did Miyazaki's Studio Ghibli's Miyazaki's winning of the Academy Award for a full-length animated feature for Spirited Away. I think this happened in 2003. It was the first time a Japanese animated feature had won an Oscar at all. This surprised a lot of people within the domestic sphere because anime had often been considered something that was purely a form of popular culture and not something that had any sort of artistic merit that would be the subject of an award abroad. Simply by the numbers, and again, I'm here in my personal capacities. I'm sure that someone can find more exact numbers than I'm putting on this slide. Other forms of Japanese popular culture were quite popular abroad. Economically, manga sales in the U.S. topped $100 million. Game sales figures I don't have, but I think it's fair to say that by 2003, nearly every American knew who Mario was, despite Mario being an Italian name. Much of America was enthralled, perhaps it's fair to say, with Japanese popular culture. And Japan noticed this. So we started to see public and private responses to this phenomenon abroad. Here on the left, we have the Cool Japan Story Contest, by which high schoolers all across Japan were encouraged to find unexpectedly appealing places around them that might interest foreigners, and craft narratives about them that would attract more people to their hometowns. I served as a judge on the panel. It was very interesting. Over here on the left, we have a private effort called the Tool Japan Award, which purportedly takes Japanese products, puts them in front of a panel of foreigners, in reality foreign exchange students, has the panel determine, come on in, whether or not that thing is cool from a foreign perspective, and then uses the Cool Japan Award branding for successful products to sell those products back to Japanese people. So here we have the first of many examples in my slides of the idea of foreignness being used by Japanese stakeholders to induce interest from Japanese consumers. Foreignness is a foil here. In addition to public and private distinct efforts, there's also combined efforts. The one that tends to draw the most headlines is the Cool Japan Fund, which was founded a few years ago, with an impressive initial investment of roughly $500 million, purportedly to support efforts to spread Japanese culture abroad. I'm just going to repeat this one more time. Generally speaking, when someone is saying Cool Japan, they might be referring to government initiatives, they might be referring to private enterprises using the branding, they might be referring to the underlying phenomenon. Clearly, the underlying phenomenon is at the crux of all of this stuff, but it isn't entirely clear what anyone might mean simply by using the words Cool Japan. It has to be understood in a more dense context. And because of this capacity for confusion and conflation, you get interesting phenomena occurring, like people who are part of the Cool Japan phenomenon criticizing the idea of Cool Japan. I expect that some people in the room will be familiar with these two gentlemen. Murakami Takashi is arguably the most popular contemporary Japanese artist in the world right now. Gackt is a very popular pop singer who performs abroad in Asia quite a bit. Both of these men have come out publicly in newspaper articles saying things to the effect of, I want nothing to do with Cool Japan. Please do not approach me with Cool Japan offers. I do not like it. Which is interesting because both of them are quite successful abroad, so one might presume that they are representatives of the phenomenon itself. So what does it mean when they say, I want nothing to do with Cool Japan, when inherently they're part of Cool Japan? In addition to people who are part of the Cool Japan phenomenon criticizing Cool Japan, you have people who are actually part of government efforts of Cool Japan criticizing Cool Japan. Over here, we have an author who used to be a bureaucrat in the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry who quit his job to become an academic in the UK and write a book saying, why does everyone hate Cool Japan? Over on the left, you have an essay that was published in Studio Ghibli's literary magazine that uses the very blunt title, Kuru Japan wa Kuru Janai. That is, in English, Cool Japan is not cool. Generally speaking, Japanese titles are not quite this direct, so one could presume that some of the bureaucrats that read this essay were offended. I'm fortunate to be in the position to say that, to my knowledge, not too many people were offended by this. I know this because I wrote the essay myself. It was because of this essay that I was named the Cool Japan Ambassador. So I am part of the phenomenon from an official standpoint because I've come out in public to be against it, or at least certain aspects of it. But what exactly is it even supposed to be about? I dug around on the Cool Japan website for sort of a representational quote. This came out of Tomomi Inada, who in 2014 was, I believe, the first or perhaps the second Cool Japan minister. And I think it's interesting because even though she's talking about an international phenomenon, she's phrasing it in very domestically targeted terms. So I position the Cool Japan strategy as a social movement for each of us, that is, Japanese people. It's written in English, but this is for Japanese people, to rediscover various aspects of Japan's attractiveness and then disseminate it to the world. Which is kind of interesting when you think about it, right? So presumably, the idea here is for Japanese people to use an international phenomenon to rediscover aspects of their own culture and then disseminate it to the world. But if the world is what's providing the impetus for them to rediscover things, why are those two actions connected at the end of things? Why do they need to be the ones to disseminate something that presumably was disseminated wide enough that they can already have a reaction to it in the first place? Even within the government's programs qualitative data, it still is a little bit confusing. Here is a somewhat comprehensive list of all of the Cool Japan branded programs within the government. There's roughly $4 billion, and maybe it's close to $3.5 billion within Cool Japan efforts, but it's somewhat difficult to see how all of them are coordinated. There are programs that are run by the Foreign Ministry, there's programs that are run by the Tourism Ministry, there are programs that are run by the Tax Ministry to give tax-exempt status to, say, certain promotional efforts. But it's very, very hard to see exactly what the unifying vision is. Because I'm talking about something that is an abstraction, perhaps even of an abstraction, I think that it would be easier to continue this one-sided discussion with a very, very concrete example, which I am the world's expert on. There is no one in the world who knows more about this example of Cool Japan affecting something abroad in a concrete way, and that is because I am talking about myself. No laughter. You guys are a tough crowd. Thank you. the story of Japan and me. How did I become interested in Japan? How did Japan become unexpectedly appealing to me and draw me to live in the country and become a Cool Japan ambassador? I was born in 1983, right around here. When I grew up, I was not surrounded by Japanese relatives. I did not have any Japanese friends, to my knowledge. And yet, when I was a high school student, I went to Japan. And after I graduated college, I've been living there ever since. And the reason is because when I was four, I made a very important Japanese or perhaps Italian friend named Mario, who was supposed to be a Father's Day present for my father, but my father never got a chance to play it because I wouldn't let him. I thought that the Nintendo system that I had requisitioned from him was the bee's knees. I played it every day. I played it and played it, probably somewhat to the consternation of my parents. But in doing so, I think I subconsciously inundated myself with Japanese images, Japanese tropes, various aspects of Japanese popular culture that would then go on to drive my interest to find other areas of Japan interesting. So say, for example, here we have Mario again on one of these slides. I wonder if anyone in the audience recognizes specifically what Mario that is? Yes, in the back. Yes, it is Tanuki Mario! Round of applause for Anthony. not Raccoon Mario, but Tanuki Mario. Distinct from Raccoon Mario, because even though both of them can fly, only Tanuki Mario, when in danger, can change into an invincible statue. Which, you know, kind of sounds ridiculous when, if I'm up at a lectern saying this thing. But the reason that I'm pointing it out is because within Japanese yokai folklore, you have these images of tanuki raccoon dogs that are able to transform into statues. This is something that you see a lot in popular Japanese media. There is a Studio Ghibli film that features the tanuki's transformative ability up and, what do you call it, up and forefront. But I was familiar with this transformative ability all the way at the age of probably around 7 because I needed to learn it if I wanted to beat Super Mario Bros. 3. As I got older, I became interested in other forms of Japanese popular media. Here's Kemagore Orange Road, an anime that I liked very much, and I probably became interested in because I recognized tropes from the video games. I then went on to become interested in manga, the Japanese comics. And I became so interested in it as a medium that I decided to find out more about it, why it was so distinct from American comics, why some of the features that I saw in it, like onomatopoeia for silence, existed when I had never seen them before. So I was very fortunate, and I picked up this book, Manga Manga, The World of Japanese Comics, by Frederick Schott. This was published in 1983 and was the first English full-length book ever to be published on the media of manga. And I found it just mind-blowing. For example, I would read the sections on Kozure Okami and Gogo 13 and just be fascinated that there were comics that existed that featured protagonists who were assassins. Both of those titles, which I pointed out, have paid assassins as their main character. It's a little bit morally gray, but I was surprised by this because I had never seen it in America before. And I wanted to read those comics and find out more about the medium, but I found myself in a bit of difficulty because at the time, not many of these titles had been translated into English. So I wanted to read more manga comics and play more Japanese video games, but I couldn't do it in English. I would have to do it in Japanese. This is what led me to confront my high school principal and demand Japanese language classes. It was the first and perhaps only time in my high school's history that someone went to the principal and asked for more homework. But I did it because I really, really wanted to read more comics and play more video games. That is the honest truth. In addition to reading the popular media by using Japanese, I was also inadvertently studying Japanese by using the mediums themselves. So I'm sorry. I'll go back a little bit. So it was an interest in Japanese media and games that eventually got me to live in Japan. Here I am in a comic version of myself holding my undergraduate thesis, which I wrote about Mahjong and Mahjong popular media. I would then go on to speak at one of the world's first international Japanese-style mahjong competitions that was held in Las Vegas in 2017. So to just kind of wrap up a very simple and somewhat egotistical point, popular culture is what got me from being a little New York boy to becoming a pop cultural expert in the country. So I think that it's an example of the Cool Japan phenomenon working its magic. I managed to take many of these vignettes and turn them into my book, which Anthony was kind enough to broadcast to everyone, if you wouldn't mind passing this around. You might have noticed that in many of the slides which I showed previous to this one, I had comic representations of myself doing things like reading comics. And that is because my book is a comic book about how I learned about Japan by reading comic books. I went kind of in a meta circle there. The reason that I'm calling attention to the book specifically is because even though it's about the Cool Japan phenomenon, what I would like to problematize to all of you is whether or not the book itself counts as the Cool Japan phenomenon. So again, the book is about how I became, perhaps unexpectedly, entranced with Japanese popular culture. Does the book itself count as something which could be unexpectedly appealing to foreign audiences? It's about it, but is it itself it? Just to review, Cool Japan, at least in my experience, generally refers to government initiatives, private branding, and the underlying phenomenon. My book is not a government initiative. My book doesn't really use the Cool Japan branding. And even though it's about the phenomenon, I'm not really sure it counts as the phenomenon because it's a book written in Japanese, primarily for the Japanese market. So it's about international stuff, but it's a domestic-facing consumer product. So I think that there's almost a fourth quasi-definition of Cool Japan, or possibility that people could be talking about when they say those words, which is that they're not really talking about the phenomenon itself, but a domestic reaction to the phenomena. We're talking about two distinct audiences here. One is foreigners, perhaps like I was when I was little, who take an unexpected interest in Japanese popular culture. The other audience is Japanese people who take an interest in stories like mine. One is an initial reaction. The second is a secondary and reactionary phenomena. But they're distinct and they're different. But often they're conflated. So just to be very, very clear, the book's about Cool Japan, but it doesn't really count as Cool Japan, in my opinion. It's not the only form of media popular in Japan right now that centers on the phenomenon, but itself, I think, is separate to the phenomenon. Does anyone in the audience recognize this television show? Yes, what is it? Yeah, very good. Thank you. Or in English, why did you come to Japan? This is a show that has been on the air in the country for roughly 7 years. It is fairly close to being a household name, and it showcases images of foreigners who come to Japan to do something that is perhaps unexpected to Japanese eyes. So it showcases the phenomenon of Cool Japan. But it itself, I think, is separate from the phenomenon of Cool Japan because it's not a show for non-Japanese people. I mean, it's in Japanese. This woman is Canadian, but most Canadians would probably not understand what was going on in this photo. The interesting thing, I think, about that show specifically is that even though it centers on the phenomenon, but it's really for domestic audiences, government initiatives for Cool Japan have taken it as an index of expertise on the phenomenon itself. Just this year, at the annual official meeting for Cool Japan public and private efforts, the keynote speaker for this conference, which contained about 100 experts on potential foreign appeal of Japanese products, the keynote speaker was the very creator of that show, who came up and told the audience about trends in how foreigners with an interest in Japan were depicted in his show, which is, of course, a separate thing from aggregate foreign interest. We're not talking about how people were interested in the show. We're talking about how he presented them within the show. But this was taken at the same thing at a very important annual meeting hosted by the government, which I found somewhat peculiar because he's not exactly talking about foreign interests so much as how he's depicting foreign interests. So he's not really talking about something foreign, but rather something domestic that's produced in Japan largely for Japanese eyeballs. That's not the only show that's on the air, though. There is a show called Cool Japan itself that has been on NHK, Japan's public broadcaster, since 2006. It's been on the air for 13 years. It does the same sort of thing. Features a panel of foreigners who get a Japanese product or concept put in front of them every episode and are then asked what they think is cool about it. At the end of each episode, the Japanese host gets to pick exactly what Japanese thing is appropriate enough to be sent out to the outside world as a representation of Japanese cool, which is an interesting dynamic because the foreigners are used as credibility fodder to show that something is cool or is not cool, but in actuality, control over what gets determined as cool is entirely within the hands of the Japanese producers. They pick what the theme is, and then ultimately, the host gets to pick what gets lauded as cool. But even though I'm a little bit skeptical, perhaps I'm being unfair, let's look at a specific example of what this show, which shares a name with the phenomenon itself, showcased as something to represent to the world as, a good example of what is cool about Japan. When I first put these slides together, I went to the Facebook page, copy-pasted exactly what was there. It was mangoes. I bet everyone here, when you think of mangoes, you think of Japan, right? Or alternatively, when you think about what's appealing about Japan, I'm sure the first thing that comes to mind is mangoes. If there's anything that has to do with traditional Japanese culture, it's a mango. Clearly I'm being facetious, but I did think that it was a little bit odd that mangoes would be the headline feature for a show that is supposed to be representative about what is cool about Japan, at least in foreign eyes. I do not think I know anyone who has ever said, oh yes, I love mangoes, and that is why I am going to Japan. But maybe I'm being unfair, or maybe I just picked a bad example. Or maybe after being on the air for 13 years, it's so hard to find fresh things to make the show about that they might as well pick mangoes, which are a delicious product of Miyazaki Prefecture. So it turns out that in the first year of broadcasting, Cool Japan, the show, created a Best of Cool competition by which they took all of the things that had been designated as cool in their initial year and had their foreign panelists kind of put them head-to-head to pick the one coolest thing, the best of cool, presumably the most representational Japan product or concept for the entire Cool Japan phenomenon. So I'll open it up to the audience. What do you think they picked? What do you think is the best of cool? What's the coolest thing about Japan? Cartoons, sushi, Hello Kitty. Any takers? No one at all. Karaoke? Kobe beef? No? Nothing? I guess I'll just give you the answer. A washlet toilet. Really? This is what you show to people. If someone says, hey, show me one thing that's cool about Japan, would you show them a washlet toilet? For those of you who are not familiar with washlet toilets, these are very, very popular add-ons for your restroom in Japan that use a, mechanized additions that will, say, heat the toilet seat for you or automatically open a door shut. There's bidet functionality as well. I can't believe I'm saying this in front of a camera. By and large, I think it's fair to say that anyone who comes to Japan from a Western country and experiences these things thinks that it's pretty cool. And I mean, it does have a fairly universal appeal, given that there aren't too many people who don't use one of these or its equivalents at all. But, is this really what's supposed to be representative of the phenomenon? Maybe it was a fluke. Maybe for their first anniversary special, they just had to pick something that would be a little bit sensational. They also did a 100th broadcast special of the Best of Cool. So not just their first year, out of their first 100 episodes, presumably this would be about 2 years, what do you think won out this time? All the cool things going head-to-head, what wins out? 100 cool things about Japan. What's the coolest? What's the best of cool? Ladies and gentlemen, we have a winner. the joy of putting toilets on slides aside, what exactly is this supposed to mean? I mean, is it supposed to boil down the Cool Japan phenomenon to a toilet? Probably not. But the message was there, and the message was repeated, so presumably there is an appeal and a meaning behind this, and I'd like to take a little bit of a critical look at it. If you put a toilet on a screen and you get a positive reaction about it, why did you get a positive reaction about it? To answer my own question, I think it's because you're showing it to people who already know what it is. Someone who has already used an automated washlet toilet will know the appeal of using it, and will be able to understand when you're like, hey, those washlet toilets, they're great, aren't they? But, on the other hand, someone who is not familiar with Japan, someone who could presumably be unexpectedly interested in Japan, someone who is supposed to be the target of the Cool Japan branding and governmental programs, who has never used one of these before, if they ask you, hey, tell me something cool about Japan, and you're like, you know, the toilets, that's the best thing, they're not really going to be able to understand you because they don't understand how a washlet toilet could be distinct from the toilets which they've used in day-to-day life. So in other words, this message is only understandable to people who are already familiar with the idea, which to me makes it a message that's not really of Cool Japan, but rather a reaction to the Cool Japan phenomenon. Here's another example. I found this poster in the Tokyo subway just a couple of weeks ago. Let's take a look at it. It says Tokyo, Tokyo. Tokyo on the left in traditional brush script. Tokyo on the, I guess to you it's the right and the left, on the other side in a more modern printed font, perhaps to showcase the juxtaposition between the traditional and modern aspects of Tokyo. The large visual image front and center is of a blonde woman wearing a kimono. So the showcasing here is international aspects of Tokyo, the juxtaposition of old and new Tokyo, messages which I think by and large will resonate primarily with Japanese people. It's an international motif, but the producers and the target of the message are Japanese. So it's international foil being used for a domestic message. And I mean, more to the point, all this text is written in Japanese, so presumably most non-Japanese would never be able to understand this. I often hear statements about spreading the Cool Japan phenomenon amongst my contemporaries within the Cool Japan government programs that I find a little bit curious when you're considering exactly what the message is and who it's targeted towards. Let me go through them one by one. So I often hear, Nihon no kaigai no fan wo fuyasou. Let's increase international fans of Japan. Which I think is a laudable goal, but if you're trying to do it with that sort of messaging, I think the best that you're going to be hoping for is engaging people who are already interested in Japan. So increasing the market is being conflated with engaging people who are already within the market. And to be frank, I think that most of the targets of those audience aren't actually foreign consumers at all, but rather domestic people. Moving on, Nihon no bunka wo hashin shimashou. Let's spread Japanese culture around the world. Which some of the Cool Japan program is doing, but messages like this, I don't think actually spread culture, but rather they spread a qualification or evaluation. So again, you have conflation with the primary phenomenon and reactions to the phenomenon. Showing a show about people's reactions to culture to other people is not going to spread the culture, it's going to spread the reactions. And then finally, I hear a lot about Nihon no kuru no essence wo shite shimashou. Determining the essence of a phenomenon that is inherently subjective, how exactly do you determine the essence of why anything is cool? And if you're forcing the issue, what happens when you wind up choosing something like a toilet? I mean, would anyone seriously argue that the essence of Japanese cool is most represented in a toilet? And more to the point, all of this discourse about what's cool about Japan, looking at it point blank from the perspective of someone who's never heard of this phenomenon beforehand, what exactly, I wonder, does it accomplish? If you're trying to get someone interested in something, let's say a child who you think should be interested in math, is the most effective way to do that to look at the child and say, hey, math is cool. She's not looking at me, which is, I think, the perfect reaction. I mean, you're going to get a reaction like this. I don't think anyone responds well to being dictated to them what their own value system should be about anything, including whether or not they find something appealing. And I think that's exactly why you see people who are very representative of this phenomenon very vehemently reacting against it, because they're seeing their own fans and what they represent essentially being co-opted into a valuation of Japan at large, which they never intended and which they themselves don't actually think they're part of. They think that they're part of the phenomenon in all likelihood, but they're not part of the branding and they're not part of the crafting of this image and message. So here's a couple of questions, or a few questions, which I hope that you will ponder as we go on to the next slides and perhaps provide me some reactions to during the Q&A. What is the phenomenon about? Is it about encouraging unexpected appeal, or is it about reacting to it? Is it about selecting it, or is it about searching for it? In discussing what counts as cool and what doesn't, who's supposed to be in control of that conversation? Is it for Japanese and cultural insiders, which I suppose I count as now, or is it for people who know nothing about Japan who better appreciate an outsider's perspective? And then finally, how does the idea of appropriation enter into this? Who's in control of the image? What's the image of? Where's the power dynamic? What are the political ends? For me, I tend to have a little bit of a personal take on this, because I feel that at least in my own personal experience, I am somewhat representative of how the appeal of popular culture of Japan can affect someone who never knew anything about Japan at all. I often hear people within the world tell me, hey, you know, New Yorkers love ramen, or, you know, hey, all of America cried at this particular movie. And I often react with a little bit of wonder to that because I think, well, there are probably some New Yorkers who perhaps have not encountered the joys of ramen yet. Or if I see this Zenbei ga naita copywriting, everyone in America cried at this movie, I'm thinking, well, I didn't, so how can you say that all of America cried about it? And I mean, reacting to this messaging as well, I find it somewhat perplexing because no one actually told me to think that Japan was cool. I wound up thinking this on my own. Here's another example of this at work. This gentleman is a resident of New York. His name is David Bresnik. He has been running a Japanese-style mahjong club in Manhattan for about 10 years. No one told him to do it. He's never had any governmental support for doing it, because mahjong is a somewhat taboo subject within Japan. And yet, just a couple of years ago, he wound up being the primary organizer for the World Japanese Mahjong Championship, also known as the World Ricci Championship, in Las Vegas. So he did all of this as his on his own, and yet he's entirely outside of this messaging machine about what cool Japan should be. I mean, I think he represents the phenomenon as much as anyone, but he's entirely absent from domestic reactions to cool Japan because it isn't in line with what people expect. So what do people expect, or how does the government exactly break the phenomenon down? Here's an interesting slide that I pulled out of one of the Cool Japan annual reports, which attempts to plot all things that are cool about Japan on a graph. On this axis, we have material and spiritual, and then over here we have pop and deep, so perhaps general and then deep appeal. And, I mean, we have confectionaries, convenience stores on this end. Up here we have Zen and Japanese martial culture. Right here we have the toilet. The toilet actually has its own place on an official slide put out by the central Japanese government. I mean, I'm serious. This is on the internet for anyone to see. It takes a toilet and puts it on a graph about what's cool. In the same presentation, I see this Venn diagram taking what the world thinks is cool about Japan, what Japanese people think is cool about Japan, looking at the overlap and then trying to extend it and extend what the world thinks is cool about Japan. But I wonder, well, if it's about foreign reactions, or if it's about foreign appeal, why should domestic appeal enter into the conversation at all? Is this trying to purport that the real agency for foreign appeal about Japan is actually driven by Japanese people's appeal towards their own culture? And I mean, more simply put, what exactly is this trying to say at all? When have you ever seen appeal about a nation's brand been put into a Venn diagram by this? I mean, honestly, I look at this and I'm not entirely sure what it means. But lucky for me, the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry put out a comic-style form of explaining the Cool Japan phenomenon very simply for children, and presumably women as well, where we have this very helpful and perhaps somewhat condescending-looking Japanese man explaining that Cool Japan is about the cool aspects of Japan, or cute aspects of it, including fashion, comics, animation, games, food, hospitality, things that are around everyone, and everything that is appealing about Japan, that is what cool Japan is. But it's a self-referencing explanation, so it doesn't really mean all that much. And I mean, he goes on to say, I mean, here we have this wonderful child with like a conductor's hat, asking, you know, how it gets driven, how can we spread more about Japan's good things to foreigners? And again, the helpful man with his eyes closed says that the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry is selling its stuff overseas and is using overseas media enterprises so that the information can be spread abroad. So again, he's taking the agency and making it domestically located. He's saying that Japan is the one spreading things. And then presumably the locus of this phenomenon is in Japan. From looking at these explanations, these graphs, my own personal conversations with people, I found that these assumptions tend to be quite pervasive within domestic spheres of people talking about cool Japan. People often talk using the idea that cool Japan and the international appeal of Japanese popular culture is a recent phenomenon that perhaps dates back to the coining of the term itself in 2002. People talk about Japanese cool as something that is transmitted from Japan to the outside world, like in that last slide. The ministry is making efforts to sell all of this abroad. And finally, it's at least my impression that people assume that the essence of popularity about Japan has to do with something inside Japan. The reason why Japan is suddenly appealing to the outside world is about something having to do with Japan itself. And if you're talking about the secondary domestic reaction to foreign appeal, I think that all of these make sense. So again, not talking about foreign appeal itself, but talking about the Japanese reaction to foreign appeal, I think that all of these apply. I mean, things like the Cool Japan Fund were created in response to this phenomenon and are recent. Wonderful efforts, like the Ministry of Foreign Affairs 12th, the International Manga Award, is, I think, a wonderful government-led, top-down effort to spread Japanese culture to the world that works, but it itself is also recent. But if you're talking about the phenomenon directly, I think that all those assumptions are wrong. It's not recent, it's not transmitted from Japan to the outside world, and it isn't even located within Japan primarily. All of this stuff to actually be flipped on its head. The phenomenon has a history of over 100 years. It's not spread primarily from Japan to the outside. It's spread outside of Japan, further outside. And the essence of the popularity, I think, is actually not found in Japan at all. It's found outside Japan. And ukiyo-e, I think, is at the crux of this example. If you think of Japanese cool Japanese imagery, an image that anyone would associate with cool Japan, I would point to one of the 36 views of Mount Fuji as written by Hokusai, the very famous woodblock print artist. It is fairly universally recognizable. It is easily commercialized. I still don't really understand why a toilet was picked on that television program when this is right there. I think you would be hard-pressed to find anyone in the developed country that didn't at least know that this was a Japanese image. But why is it internationally popular? But at the time it was popular, it wasn't really considered to be something that was representative of Japan, not something that was the height of Japanese art. It was very similar to how comics are perceived today. It wasn't considered to be especially valuable. Often ukiyo-e prints were used to wrap old fish and were thrown out after they were read. And when Japan first decided to showcase its culture to the West during the Paris Expo in the 19th century, it avoided the promotion and distribution of ukiyo-e. And yet that same medium went on to be, at least in my view, representative of Japanese art and culture at large. It was thought of as being, low popular culture beforehand. Now it's regarded as high enough to be representative of the country on its own currency. This is the new proposed design for the 1,000 yen bill, the lowest and most common form of Japanese paper currency. So why did the change happen? Was it because Hokusai was famous? Probably not. Most of Hokusai's international fame happened after he passed away. Probably the watershed moment for woodblock prints and the later Japanese-me art movement that wound up inspiring Impressionism probably happened during the 1867 Paris Expo, which was the first time that the Japanese government, by and large, decided to make a concentrated and official effort to spread its artistic culture to the West. After the expo, you started to see very obvious similarities in European art from Hokusai prints. Here's a cover of one of Debussy's albums. It's probably the same wave. Here is a portrait written by Vincent van Gogh, who, to my knowledge, never actually went to Japan, and yet draws a portrait with things like Mount Fuji and a woman who is almost certainly a representative of Japan in the background. So something probably happened at that expo. And after the work was discovered and spread throughout Europe, the people who took the strongest interest in spreading it were European artists and European art critics. which is to say, it wasn't the long reach of the Japanese government saying, okay, here's where the ukiyo is, here we're going to spread it throughout Europe, but rather you had it introduced during the expo, and then the Europeans were the ones who spread it throughout the world themselves, European exports. As to specifically why it was popular, I can only make a subjective guess. I have read that it presented aesthetics in a way that had been previously unknown in European art, and was popular then because the art world there had reached a period of stagnation in which people were hungry for something new. Ukiyo-e also often features everyday scenes and subjects, which were absent from many media in Europe at the time, because they tended to either feature the rich patrons who had paid for the art, or still lifes like fruit. So the appeal was there. The appeal, was spread by the Europeans themselves, not the Japanese. And the reason for its appeal had more to do with what was lacking in Europe than what was something quintessentially about the Japanese art itself. So I think that example alone contradicts those examples, those assumptions which I had brought up earlier. The Cool Japan phenomenon is, I think, the exact same phenomenon that led to Japanese-me, which means that it's over 100 years old. It's not spread by the Japanese establishment. It's spread by non-Japanese, and the essence of the popularity is actually found outside of Japan. But what's interesting is that I took a deeper look into exactly how ukiyo-e entered Europe, and not only is it representative of Cool Japan not being recent, not being spread by the Japan, and not being found within Japan, all of this is true even at the time of the expo, which is to say that the phenomenon predates the expo, was spread before the expo, and was spread by forces that were external to Japan even before the work was officially spread to Europe. And when you think about it, it's almost a little bit intuitive that the Paris Expo couldn't have been when ukiyo-e first went abroad, because ukiyo-e was not considered to be high art in Japan at the time. So why would official representatives of the Japanese establishment try to spread something which wasn't, to their view, the best of what Japan had to offer? More to the point, it was difficult for anyone to export ukiyo-e out of Japan before Japan was open to the world in the pre-Meiji era, because it was illegal. So how did this stuff get over there? How did this stuff suddenly get spread so quickly and almost spark the Impressionism movement if the government didn't do it and if most citizens couldn't do it because it was illegal? I am grossly simplifying this, but it had a lot to do with a European named Philip Franz von Siebold, who was deported in 1829, a few decades before Japan was opened and well before the Paris Expo, and smuggled 15 Hokusai prints with him, went back to his Dutch hometown, founded a small museum to exhibit the prints, and, this is a guess, presumably invited enough experts or people influential in the European art world to view his exhibits that, by the time the expo rolled around, there were enough people who knew what they were looking for that once they found the ukiyo-e, they could then spread it. In other words, the thing had been primed. It wasn't the expo that initially showcased it, but it rather kind of provided a catalyst point for the art to spread. So not only is Cool Japan not new now, it wasn't even a new phenomenon, or at least it didn't originate in the Paris Expo. The Hokusai prints that were brought to Japan that sparked a lot of it were brought back by non-Japanese, and presumably the Japanese establishment didn't spread them because they considered it illegal to do so. The essence of why it happened, or rather the catalyzing forces as to why it happened, were largely driven not by what Japan wanted to spread, but rather by what Europeans wanted that was new. Anime in the United States followed the exact same pattern. And the anime boom is most closely associated with the late 90s and early noughts, but the first anime club in America ever was actually founded in 1977. And what's interesting about anime clubs at the time is that most of the people who were interested in anime did not actually speak Japanese. So you would have gatherings of people who were interested in Japanese media, but couldn't actually understand what was being said on the screen. And the founder of the club actually has this fascinating quote that one of the major activities of club members was to guess what was happening. That part of the reason why anime was appealing was because they couldn't understand what was happening. The spread of the media within the U.S. was entirely fan-driven because there were no official ways of getting most Japanese animated films or of getting English language support for that. After there were more Japanese fluent members of fan clubs present in America or in this expanding fan-led network, there was an increase in what was known as fan subbers, fans who would take the animated media, create their own subtitles, and then copy VHS tapes and spread them throughout the U.S. so that other fans could appreciate the media. What's interesting is that the way that they got the tapes was also fan-led as well. Fans in America would set up exchanges with science fiction fans in Japan so that they could get originals of anime tapes, and the Japanese fans in Japan could get originals of Star Trek tapes, which they found hard to obtain. So, again, it's spread by the consumers themselves, not by the official sources. It's not about pushing stuff. It's about the consumers who are already in the target pulling it, at least in the examples that I've picked. So why, for example, would comic fans in America be so interested in Japanese stuff or Japanese media? Perhaps it's something intrinsically interesting about the Japanese media, but I would actually point more to what was lacking in America at the time. In 1954, is it three, in the early 50s, the American comic industry, in response to political pressure that perhaps was centered in the Cold War, started their own self-regulating entity called the Comics Code Authority, which prevented any politically suggestive, subservient, sexual content from being published within the industry itself. So as the decades went on, there became a lack in certain tropes and certain subjects within the American comics world because you couldn't publish it because of public pressure. So by the time the 80s and 90s were, came around, and these fans had access to Japanese media without having to stretch too far, all of a sudden they were encountering stuff that they had never encountered before. Protagonists who were criminals, for example. Sexually explicit comics. But the reason why they weren't encountering those within American comics wasn't because there's something inherent about the American comics medium that prevents subversive comment from existing. It's because this political organization prevented them from existing, so it created this artificial lack. In other words, part of the reason why Japanese manga and anime looked so special to American fans in the 90s is because the American comics industry had been hit by retrograde forces by decades and was essentially behind its Japanese counterpart. So here you have it centered not on what Japan had, but what America lacked. The same thing, I think, has to do with the spread of Japanese mahjong in the United States as well. There's no official source in Japan that is actively, as part of the government, trying to spread Japanese mahjong culture. You just have these American fans who are so into the Japanese form of the game that, at least in this photo, they're willing to set up a Japanese robotic automated mahjong table, which you cannot buy in this country, so that they can run their own authentic tournament. I took this photo myself in, I believe it was the fall of 2016. So it kind of begs the question, what exactly is the essence of the Cool Japan phenomenon itself? Well, let's start with the basics. People have found Japan enthralling since the 19th century, at least Westerners have. And they found every aspect of life here intriguing, including the people, the environment, and everything in between. So the people, the life, the environment, all of Japan that they found enthralling is the same Japan that everyone is seeing, but the way that they see it differs. So in other words, it's not about the object, but about the way that it's viewed. Japan's image, in this sense, is more important than the reality of Japan itself. It's a necessarily subjective phenomenon because it depends on the viewpoint. And one of the reasons why I think there's so much of a gap often between official Cool Japan efforts and the phenomenon itself is because it's very hard to appreciate the image of the country that you're living in right now. Cool Japan is about how people from the outside see Japan, but if you only have the reality of Japan in front of you, it's very, very difficult to separate that from an image, which might not be all that related at all. Here's a great example of this. Does anyone recognize what restaurant is in the photo? Benihana, yes. A restaurant chain that was founded in this very city. And I mean, it's very Japanese, isn't it? I mean, over here we have a chef who is dressed like all Japanese chefs are. He certainly looks very Japanese. He set fire to the table. Anyone who's been to a restaurant in Japan knows that all Japanese chefs set fire to the table. In the back, we have all of this lettering written in all sorts of different languages, which is, of course, the same in all Japanese restaurants. And, you know, not to play too much in stereotypes, but I think it's safe to assume that everyone around the table is Japanese, because this is a Japanese restaurant. Clearly, I'm being facetious. There is nothing particularly traditional about this photo when viewed in the lens of authentic Japanese food in Japan. But if you're talking about Japanese food at large, or at least Japanese food in America, Benihana is the biggest name out there. They had revenue of over $300 million in 2010. They have over 5,000 employees and 116 locations in 6 countries. And, of course, they serve steak, chicken, and shrimp, which are American food. It's a Japanese restaurant, but it serves American food because it's not really a Japanese restaurant. It's a restaurant that uses the image of Japan. But in America, that is a Japanese restaurant. It's the same thing here, but not in Japan. I think a lot of efforts to try to spread the culture of Japan instead try to spread a perspective of Japan that is seen by the country as being correct, but doesn't account for subjective notions of how Japan should look like. To be very blunt, most Americans know quite little about Japan at all, or at least the realities of day-to-day life in the country. There was a poll taken by the Pew Research Center during the height of the trade wars between U.S. and Japan in the 1980s, when Japan was in the news almost daily. The poll asked Americans to name a single Japanese person. Most Americans could not, except for Yoko Ono. Everyone was seeing the images of Japan, and yet most people could not actually name a single Japanese person because it wasn't the reality of Japan that they were consuming, but rather the image. Same thing with education about what cool Japan should be. To put it quite bluntly, most of the people who consume Japanese popular culture aren't doing it specifically to learn more about Japan. They're doing it because they find it enjoyable. Most of the people who go to Japan as tourists aren't going to learn more about the reality of Japan. They're going because they're on vacation. So it's not about qualifying what the phenomenon should be to the outside audience, I think, but rather opening the door as wide as possible so that more people come in. The irony here is that not knowing anything about Japan, I think, actually leads to success within the Cool Japan phenomenon. If you remember those anime clubs that started the spread of anime all over the United States, most of their members could not understand what was being said at all. Another great example is the best-selling Japanese-produced single of all time. It sold 13 million copies and was called Sukiyaki. For those of you who don't recognize the word, sukiyaki refers to a Japanese hot pot dish. The song was not about that at all. The song in Japanese is called Ue o Muite Aruko and is about the singer being very, very sad. It turns out that what he's specifically sad about, according to the songwriter, is having gone to a protest against the American military in Japan and losing. So this is someone who wrote a song about being sad because the American military gained a greater presence in Japan. So you could presumably think that the song's lyrics are somewhat anti-American. And yet this is the best-selling single in Japanese history of a music single in America. It's probably better that they didn't translate what it was and didn't provide context about it. Perhaps sales wouldn't have been quite as good. Talking more about conflating success in Cool Japan economic numbers and the image of Japan, if you're looking specifically to driving more people to Japan by increasing Japanese fans abroad, I think that if you look at the numbers, you'll notice an ironic pattern. Most foreigners who go to Japan to enjoy its tourism resources are coming from South Korea and China. According to a Pew Research Center poll in 2013, supermajorities of both of those countries answered on the poll that they found the image of Japan to be unfavorable. And yet they're still coming. So what's changed exactly there? If they had a negative image of Japan, but they're coming more and more, what's driving that? If it isn't that the image of Japan is getting better in their country, maybe it's something else. Maybe, for example, it's just simple increased buying power, which is an entirely domestic-centered phenomenon. So, I mean, here again, you have the reality of the phenomenon that differs almost entirely from the Japan-led discourse about it. But ultimately, it doesn't even matter if they have a negative view or a positive view. All that matters is that they're coming at all. Why are they coming? What's the image that they're coming to? I think what's important to bear in mind is that the image actually never existed. This is a wonderful quote by a 19th century writer who I hope some people in the audience are familiar with. What exactly is Oscar Wilde saying when he says that Japan, the country, and the people don't exist? Presumably, he's not saying that Japan itself doesn't exist or that Japanese people don't exist. That would mean that when I try to go home, I wouldn't actually be able to. He's not saying that real Japan doesn't exist. He's saying that the image never existed at all. That the image is so ephemeral that you can't actually tie it to concrete things, and that the appeal of Japan is not actually linked so much to what's there, but rather what's not there, or what its mystique is. Which means that you can't actually find the essence of what's appealing about Japan without leaving Japan and seeing what the lack is. I mean, in some sense, it's kind of like ignorance is bliss. When I first went to Japan as a teenager, I thought that the entire country was made out of electronic stores and used bookstores and video arcades and maybe the occasional temple. It's not a realistic picture of Japan, and I certainly don't have this perspective of Japan right now, but I think that it was necessary for me to have this fantastic picture of the country in order to become more enthralled with it later. Again, though, we're talking about two separate things. How people get interested in the country, and then Japanese people's reaction to that. And it's very hard to move forward without separating the two ideas. Where the establishment runs into problems is where it doesn't provide this distinction, or doesn't provide distinction within foreign populations. Does anyone recognize the blue robot cat in this image? Doraemon, very good. Would you think that most Americans would recognize that blue robot cat? No. So, Doraemon is an anime image that's very popular in Japan, and also very popular in Southeast and Central and East Asia. He was selected in 2008 as the Ministry of Foreign Affairs anime ambassador. And bureaucrats from the ministry would go to comic conventions in the United States wearing Doraemon, or at least one of them wore a Doraemon mask, went up to everyone and said, "Hey, who am I?" And no one at the convention knew, because he's only really appealing to Asia, not to America at all. So here again, we have the establishment confusing some foreign appeal to universally generalized appeal. The Cool Japan word itself, I think, is an example of something that is appealing more to foreigners as a foil for Japanese people than what's actually appealing to the West. The phrase Cool Japan is originally Japanese, Kuru Japan. It's not English. Kuru is more a loanword from English than it is an actual mapping on of English. Japan, to a Japanese person, refers to this foreign perspective of Japan. It's not the actual word for Japan, which is Nihon or Nippon. It's kind of like in English saying that Japan has a certain je ne sais quoi. Does anyone here speak French? What does je ne sais quoi mean in French?
I don't know. It means I don't know.
But does it grammatically mean that?
Yeah.
It's grammatically appropriate? It's a little bit weird, isn't it? It wouldn't be how a French person would say it, right?
But it's like fancy.
Fancy. So here I think we have something which sounds perhaps a little bit more fancy to Americans than it might to French native speakers. Maybe. I think that the Cool Japan terminology is exactly the same. It's a term that's kind of been taken from English to mean something cool in Japan. But in English, it's just a country referring to itself as cool, which is probably not all that cool. Here's another example that I spotted in an airport. In Haneda Airport in Tokyo, one of the international airports, when people from passenger planes docking in Tokyo's international airport enter a certain hallway, they will see this poster that says, "Welcome to Mount Yamanashi." For those of you who are familiar with Japanese geography, Tokyo is not in Yamanashi. Yamanashi is next to Tokyo. If you are landing in Tokyo International Airport, you are not in Yamanashi, and presumably you cannot be welcomed to Yamanashi yet. It's an indirect message saying, "We welcome you to Yamanashi," or please come to Yamanashi. I think, though, that any Japanese person looking at this phrase will recognize it and be able to make this contextual jump to being welcome to coming to Yamanashi, which I think means essentially that the message is more easily understandable by Japanese people than by English native speakers, which makes me question its utility. Here's another fun example, a sign in an airport put up by a Japanese airline. Please enjoy our safe and comfortable flight. In Japanese, if you use quote marks, it's kind of the equivalent of bold or italics. But in English, if you use the same quote marks, it's kind of like saying that something is hearsay and perhaps not true. The statement kind of calls attention to whether or not the flight really is that safe or really is that comfortable. Again, though, a Japanese, what do you call, second language learner of English would look at the quote marks, recognize them as the same stress marks in Japanese, and think that they were entirely appropriate. So again, inadvertently or not, I think that this message is actually more for Japanese than it is for non-speakers of Japanese. Here's another fun one in Kamakura. I don't know if anyone here has been to Kamakura, but it's where there's a very big Buddha statue. Everyone wants to go to the Big Buddha, but that's not the actual official name of the place. The Big Buddha statue is located within a temple. The temple is called Kotoku-in. Most Japanese people familiar with the Big Buddha don't even know that it's actually in a place called Kotoku-in. So, this helpful sign that points to Kotoku-in writes in parenthesis, Daibutsu, which means Big Buddha. So, hey, it's Kotoku-in, but if you don't recognize the name, it's where the Big Buddha is. And then, to be very helpful to people who don't understand these characters, you see foreign language translations of it. Kotoku-in has been rendered as Kotoku-in Temple. And then Daibutsu, which means Big Buddha, has been rendered as Daibutsu in Roman characters. Some helpful person put up Big Buddha as a sign underneath there. But, I mean, again, you have a sign which, I think, again, taking the intention out of it, has the functional capacity of signifying that something is international without it actually being internationally focused. I don't think that most international visitors to Kamakura will get much utility out of this sign. It's not to just pick on Japan. I mean, this happens on both sides of the aisle. Here's an image from an American video game featuring a very powerful-looking wrestler with two Chinese-origin characters on his back. This means pain. This means wind. Perhaps he is the wind of pain, striking pain on his enemies. But in Japanese context, it doesn't actually work that way. Pain and wind put together means gout. Gout, a thyroid disorder. He probably doesn't have gout. I could show more images of people with, inappropriate Chinese tattoos, but you can find them on the internet very easily. Other surprising things that come out of Japanese into English that are somewhat unexpected. How many people here knew that head honcho comes from Japanese? Just a skosh, ever hear that? That comes from Japanese. Happening in a rickshaw, all of those are Japanese origin words. Confusing the original language with what's been put into the target language in different meanings is not something that's limited only to Japan. It happens in America, too. But what's curious, I think, about many internationally focused or purportedly internationally focused efforts in Japan is that it's difficult to see how they could have any sort of internationally facing utility at all. Here is a page from the Yokoso Japan campaign in 2008. This is one of Japan's international tourism campaigns. It's supposed to encourage international tourism, but it uses the word Yokoso, which presumably most international tourists will not know. It means welcome, but it differs from, say, other international tourism campaigns like Malaysia Truly Asia, which would be comprehensible to most people who do not speak Malaysian, or to many people who do. So I always find it curious that they made this name out of it. At the bottom, you see a bunch of stamps. That's because the Postal Service in Japan created a set of commemorative stamps for the international tourism campaign, but they're all for 80 yen, which is the domestic rate at the time, meaning that the only usage case for these commemorative stamps, which commemorate an international tourism campaign, is for people in Japan to send letters to other people in Japan. So it's entirely domestic, so one wonders why they actually branded it with the international campaign at all. Yeah, Yokoso. And I wonder if it's because that was actually the entire purpose of the campaign itself, or of Cool Japan itself, that's kind of tongue-in-cheek. I mean, again, Cool Japan Strategy is a social movement not for the international world, but for Japanese people to rediscover various aspects of Japan. So perhaps by design, the international perspective wasn't seriously considered. It was just supposed to be a foil itself. The Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry put out this fascinating program, pamphlet called Wonder Japan, which it distributed to all of the embassies and many foreign-led establishments in Tokyo, that told its readers, who were presumably all foreign stakeholders, did you realize that Japan is getting this much attention? So, I mean, again, they disseminated a pamphlet that's supposed to spread stuff about Japan, and the pamphlet leads in saying, did you realize that Japan is getting this much attention? It's kind of like me asking the audience right now, did you realize that there are a lot of people coming to my presentation? I mean, either it's true, and I didn't need to tell it to you, or it's not true, and I'm contradicting myself by sending the message itself. Why have the message at all if you're not actually, if you're talking about it? But I don't think that this message is meaning to be referring to anything having to do with the primary phenomenon, but rather the message itself. In other words, it's meant to index itself, not to spread anything about Japanese tourism. And here I just kind of wanted to open up as a question. If you take these images of Japan, these images of foreign appeal in Japan that are made by Japanese stakeholders, how does this relate to images of Japan that are featured in America, say at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts several years ago, that were quite controversial? We have the same image of a blonde woman in a kimono. I mean, I don't know if she's exactly blonde, but she certainly looks foreign. At the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, this attracted quite a lot of critical attention from Asian American activists who said that their image was being appropriated as exoticism, as Orientalism. But here you have a very large and powerful Japanese entity, the Tokyo subway system, doing the exact same thing for themselves. I mean, again, this poster targets Japanese people. So how is it different? What's actually appropriative? Who's in control? How does the power dynamic differ? In this show that I spoke about earlier in the presentation that shows these foreigners who have wacky and zany reasons to coming to Japan, the person who made the presentation about it, the creator of the show, said during the Cool Japan Annual Forum that he referred to all of the people on his show as you. That is to say, when he would say that he was featuring 30 foreigners on his show on one particular day, he didn't say, I featured 30 foreigners. He said, I featured 30 yous. A you is a foreigner who is interested in Japan on his show. This is something that can be counted. I have to say, as someone who sat in the audience hearing foreigners referred to as yous that can kind of be counted as stacked, I kind of wondered if he considered me to be a you as well. The message must be domestically focused because I think that anyone who was featured in the program who heard themselves being referred to as a you would probably not feel entirely comfortable. I mean, again, with this image of mangoes being representative of Cool Japan, I don't think a single person on earth actually has ever said, mangoes are what brought me to Japan. And yet we have it headlining an internationally broadcast television show. What I don't see are actual real examples of foreigners who I know personally taking a strong interest in Japan. Here's a delightful example. My friend Alexander, who is somewhat well-known within popular culture for being the translator of a game called Final Fantasy, in the brand of Final Fantasy, I once asked him what initially got him interested in Japan. He gave this very unexpected answer. He said that he was on a plane from China to Japan once, and he spotted that the menu in Japanese looked really interesting. And that's what prompted him to start studying Japanese. This is a true example, but nothing I've seen within Cool Japan media even comes close to raising this as a reason why people are interested in Japan. Rather, I see efforts like what I depict in this slide. This is from a campaign called Sugoi Japan, which was led by media conglomerate Dentsu and the largest newspaper in the world by circulation, the Yomiuri Shimbun, as a way to rank articles of Japanese popular culture in order of how much appeal fans in Japan want them to have abroad. So, for example, here we have Shingeki no Kyojin, which in the manga category was deemed number one in what Japanese fans want to see succeed abroad. And they determine this by taking a poll of Japanese fans, asking what popular culture should we send to the outside world. I'm going to say this again. They determine what was appropriate to send to the outside world by asking fans who were not in the outside world, fans domestically. So it's a little bit ironic, isn't it? What's even more ironic about Shingeki no Kyojin, Attack on Titan, is that regardless of whether or not domestic fans thought it should be spread to the world, it had already succeeded in the world by the time this contest came out. Back when the New York Times was running its manga bestseller list, Shingeki no Kyojin, this particular title, had already hit number one month after month after month. So what's the meaning in holding this contest, trying to pick what's supposed to be successful according to a domestic viewpoint, when the statistics are already out there? I think that one of the reasons is because of representation within the very bodies that determine Cool Japan messaging and Cool Japan policy. This is a list of the members of the review session for the establishment for Hubs of Cool Japan. The script is somewhat small, so I'll just tell you, nearly all of these names are of males, all of them are Japanese names, and all of these people who I have seen are not particularly young. So we have the cultural equivalent of all old white men. Even for the review session on development of human resources for Cool Japan, which one might presume might have something to do with diversity, because you're looking at how to hire people who can take an international perspective, you have the exact same thing, all Japanese names. For a committee that's supposed to tell people how to hire people who know about the international world. There's been some progress in this regard in Japan. This is Dr. Robert Campbell, who has been active in certain governmental efforts and I think has had a very, very helpful presence in ensuring that messaging within certain realms is both culturally and grammatically appropriate. But I would say that by and large, most images of Caucasians in Japan kind of boil down to a somewhat entertaining clown. The irony of this image is that the person depicted in it, Dr. Matthew Chozick, is himself an American university professor. So, again, if you have committees that are filled with a relatively undiverse sample, and you have pervasive media images of foreigners as somewhat non-expert and not serious, the problem is a little bit difficult to solve. What would I recommend doing is keeping the focus in the Cool Japan program on existing Cool Japan phenomenon. In other words, what's already succeeding, as opposed to trying to determine what should succeed. Keeping the qualification of the phenomenon separate from the phenomenon itself, and then empowering ambassadors, not specifically myself, but anyone who can bridge the gap between Japan and the outside world, who have a diverse range of backgrounds, who aren't just all people from the same ethnicity, age group, and gender. Because that's the way that it's always worked. I mean, historically, the people who have spread significant cultural artifacts from Japan to the world themselves have diverse backgrounds. The author of Bushido, which was a large hit in the United States and Europe in the early 20th century, Inazo, lived in the U.S. and Germany for several years. D.T. Suzuki, who was quite popular and famous in New York a few decades ago, he spread Zen Buddhist teachings in English from Japan, but before he did that, he spent about 7 years in Illinois working under a publisher of eclectic religious texts. So before he was able to spread it to the rest of the world, he spent time in the rest of the world. Frederick Schott, who wrote that manga book that I brought up in an earlier slide, he did not grow up in America. He grew up in a smorgasbord of different countries. Perhaps that's why he was able to have access to the medium as a research subject. People who have lived abroad, kikokushijo returnees in Japan, this is the key to finding effective Cool Japan policy because they're the people who are familiar with external perspectives on Japan. So I think that any governmental effort that encourages diversity, such as the JET program, such as the International Manga Award, is a wonderful thing. But more to the point, I think that this idea of trying to pick what's cool about Japan or focusing about increasing appeal about Japan is somewhat misguided because Japanese stuff has been successfully viewed as cool abroad basically as long as the country has been commercially available to the West. Ever since Japan was opened, even before Japan was opened, the West has seen Japan as mysterious, cool, alluring. it doesn't actually matter so much how Japan showcases itself, because even if it does a good job of this, or even if it does a bad job of this, I think that it winds up succeeding. So, in essence, all Japan really has to do is ride this wave of foreign-led demand and momentum that's already there. You don't have to try to be cool. Japan has always been cool. In the sense of Japanese ari no mama, basically, Japan should just keep on being Japan. And that is how I will end my presentation. Thank you all so much for listening to me. I am incredibly nervous. But don't let that stop you from asking me nice critical questions, please. Yes, sir.
So how popular is it within Japan that those comics and anime is within the old people?
Within their own people, at least within the G8, I believe that Japan has higher publication numbers of print publications than any other country. What do you call? I mean, I don't know the numbers at my fingertips, but manga, Japanese comics, Japanese anime are a daily artifact which people encounter. You can see comics all over Japan in daily life. Their reach is much wider than in America. They're not just popular mediums for entertainment. You can see government pamphlets that explain things using manga. School curricula will use manga to lay out curricula. There are signs in subway stations that use manga to tell people how to behave properly, say, on the subway. So it's pervasive, certainly more pervasive than in the United States.
So I think it's the whole concept is the catch-22. Because if you are living in your culture, everything to you is a normal way of life.
Yes.
Yet somehow somebody else see it as being cool or different. Does not really register for yourself. Because what I'm doing is extremely ordinary. I just kind of like eat, sleep, go to a restroom. But yet somebody say, oh, this is really cool. So it's extremely difficult for yourself to even understand why certain things is cool to some other people. I think the whole process is almost maybe Japan try to quantify or explain to themselves. What's that really mean?
I think that you're right. And I don't think that there's anything inherently problematic about this domestic narrative of, like, trying to figure out why we're cool. I mean, it certainly effectively engages Japanese media consumers. It creates popular TV shows. And I think, more to my benefit as a foreign resident of Japan, it allows Japanese residents who aren't familiar or perhaps even comfortable with increasingly diverse populations to kind of get used to the idea that different people are coming and different people are liking Japan in ways that they're not so familiar with. So I actually think that on the whole, it's very positive. The problem, I think, lies in confusing this self-creative narrative about why we're cool with the actual reasons why people are coming. Once the why we're cool starts to become this perspective force on controlling why people come, that's, I think, when you get down to like messages saying like, hey, did you know why you think that Japan is cool? Which is counterproductive at best. So it's the conflation that's the problem, not this creation of like a self-narrative. Yes, sir.
Well, so I was born in Japan, now living in the States. So from that perspective, I pretty much agree with all the criticism of the cool Japan, especially the one government has been trying to do. But my concern is that now the Japanese government and mass media is so creating this, Japan is so cool, or, Nihon sugoi kind of discourses, pretty much it was domestically oriented, right?
Right.
As the audience. So it's, and also the cool Japan is pretty much about the image of Japan, not about the reality,
Yes.
So it's almost like, in my language, it's a very bad form of cultural nationalism.
Sure.
It gives almost like a pride and a very narcissistic idea about Japan. Oh, now everybody looking at me, right? Forgetting about the whole the contradiction, something uncool about Japan, including reality. For instance, in the historically, the discourse of cool Japan is coming after the Japanese economy went down.
Sure.
It's already a proof of certain failure as a nation state, right? And also the aging society, and also the international problem, or even the international policies have certain kind of tensions. In such a point when this kind of propagating the positive idea or positive image of Japan as a reality is quite a dangerous way to go, right, in domestic area.
Perhaps.
Yeah. That's what, just my comment. But the flip side of it, it's kind of related to this Boston Museum one.
Sure.
I'm curious how would you respond. Not so much about it, but since it's this place, Asia America, it's a CUNY's Asian American Institute. So, do you think this, regardless of Japan might have some issues or problems domestically, however, some of the non-Japanese people have find Japan is appealing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Japan assigned by the outside. Does it contribute to something positive or something negative to the Japanese American community, or some image, increasing image of Japan?
I think that that's for them to determine. I think that from a purely Japanese perspective, keeping this distinct from a Japanese-American perspective, that there's almost universally positive regard for foreigners who come to Japan, particularly Westerners who come to Japan, but even the majority Chinese and South Korean tourists who come and want to try kimono and wear them around town. I don't think I've ever seen a negative reaction, or at least an outward negative reaction, to people who wear kimono in public in Japan. By and large, the reaction, as I understand it, is, hey, these people are interested in our culture, or look, kimono are becoming international. One person at one of my lectures actually said that they thought, and they really said this. I don't know if they were being facetious. I don't think they were. But they said that they thought that any Japanese person going abroad should have to prove that they're proficient in kimono or the tea ceremony in order to most properly represent Japan to the outside world. So presumably, I mean, this is not the only time I've heard an opinion like that. And presumably the flip side of it is that saying that foreign interest in Japan should encounter kimono and fancy things like tea verse. So presumably these sorts of people would like it. As to how that advances the Japanese-American community, I mean, I don't know. If Japanese-Americans feel that images like these are appropriative of their own traditions, I would be interested in hearing why. But if this is appropriative, and honestly, I don't know one way or the other, I would say that what's interesting is, at least from my perspective, that appropriation is actively welcomed in Japan and, in fact, co-opted. This is not an image that was created abroad. This is an image that was created by the Tokyo subway system targeting Japanese people using, a foreign image. So if there's appropriation here, then the power dynamic is an interesting one because it's definitely Japanese people in control. It's not Japanese Americans in control. I would wonder what they have to think of this.
I was just wondering, mostly in the surface level, even compared to 20 years ago, we have more non-Japanese know about Japanese culture. So, for instance, Roland kept talking about when he brought the onigiri or something to the classroom, everybody mocked him, what the hell are you eating, right? But now people go, oh, that's onigiri. I know something from the anime. So,
I mean, it certainly could be. For those of you who aren't familiar with Roland Keltz, he's the best-selling author of Japan America, and himself a Japanese-American who grew up in America. Onigiri is a Japanese rice ball, which is very common in Japan, but not so common in day-to-day America. Perhaps young Americans have become more familiar with Japanese imagery through the recent popularity of Japanese animation and manga. I wouldn't speak to Roland's experience. It's interesting, and I think that the greater attention in Japan to Japanese popular culture's success abroad isn't just artificially driven by, say, some notion of nationalism. I mean, it really did happen. It's the tip of the iceberg, in my opinion. It's a phenomenon that originated decades beforehand and was kind of catalyzed by the internet and ease of access to foreign media. But the spike in popularity really did happen. Pokemon really did hit the cover of Time magazine. And the Japanese government, I think, at least economically speaking, was entirely correct to try to support this. I think that there are better ways that they could support it, but I think that reacting to the phenomenon just for pure economic reasons is smart thinking. Whether or not you want to say that it's politically rational to be co-opting this into a nationalist message is, I mean, again, it's something subjective. Perhaps it's effective, perhaps it's not. I don't know. I mean, is it? Where do I have my, what is it? Sugoi Japan slide. I mean, here we have a contest that was, again, sponsored by Japan's the world's largest newspaper by circulation, and I believe the world's largest advertising agency, about driving what's supposed to be international appeal of Japanese popular culture, but they only asked domestic fans their opinion. They only really advertise the results domestically. I mean, this chart is in Japanese. And its results are entirely divorced from reality. I mean, it's saying that this title should be spread abroad and entirely ignoring the fact that not only has it already been spread abroad, it's been successful.
Maybe it's really sort of kind of an example of what it is. I think at the end of the day, they want to find more other product outside of anime and comic mm-hmm. to spread out. And these lists basically, okay, this is kind of like the example, like the, what's the other thing, the Transformer mm-hmm. type of thing. Okay, Transformer successful. Mm-hmm. What else can you think about something like the Transformer type of thing that we could export again?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there are efforts that do that in Japan. JLOP is part of the Cool Japan conglomerate, I think, is a wonderful initiative. This is the part of the Cool Japan program that finds animation in Japan that should be localized or could use funding to be localized and provides funding so that English language and foreign language versions can be disseminated to the world. Several very, very popular animated features have successfully received funding from JLOP and do very well abroad. But I've never seen this advertised anywhere. This is why I'm not saying specifics, because I've never seen it advertised openly. I just know that this happened. Instead, I see a huge amount of resources put behind this effort to disseminate what's supposed to be abroad when it references no factual knowledge or no factual references about what has actually been successful abroad. I mean, the pattern should be looking for what succeeds in foreign countries, then looking for similar stuff, right? So the index should be what's already succeeded, like what sets precedent here. Instead, you're pulling it out of nothing. I mean, I don't see how this is significant in any regard except to engage domestic consumers. It doesn't really involve the international world at all. If they really wanted to figure out what international fans wanted, they would ask them. But they didn't, and they kept their website in Japanese.
How come they didn't?
I mean, I asked them.
Come to New York City and just put up a booth and have a survey and say, hi, we're from Japan. What do you think? You know, it sounds simple, but you never see it.
I mean, I would like to see it. I would like to see more engagement between the Japanese creators of popular culture and the fan communities, which are so huge in the United States.
Yeah. What's happening in Japan that's blocking it? Because Sony, I feel like Sony does a good job at this. Because mm-hmm. a lot of Americans don't really think Sony is Japanese. That's
really?
That's how much Sony has taken over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because Sony produces American music,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
American films.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Sony Animation comes out, and everybody just, you know, people buy Sony TVs, Sony cameras, and, it just does really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
But what I noticed is that Sony, they moved their headquarters from, they put up a headquarters in America, in
mm-hmm.
California.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's, you know, something that they're doing special, or, like, are they different than Sony, or... what's happening with the others that they just can't come?
Why is this effort different from, like, Sony's?
Yeah, like you said, the committee, everybody's like old Japanese men.
For the most part.
it's simple. You know, you get a plane ticket.
Mm-hmm.
You stay like a week.
Oh, like why don't they do something because it's so simple?
Yeah, that's what's happening.
I think because the incentives behind efforts like this only intend to use international images as a foil. In other words, they never intended to engage internationally. They just say that they do. I mean, I think that it's by design. When I went to this actual awards ceremony, just to kind of see it for myself, as far as I could tell, my friend and I were the only non-Japanese people in the room in an awards ceremony that was supposed to be about engaging the outside world.
Why would they pretend then?
Because it's effective. I mean, why have this image of like a blonde woman wearing a kimono to advertise Tokyo to people who already live in Tokyo?
Oh, it works with the Japanese people.
Exactly. So it's using internationalism as a foil to drive domestic interest. Actually, I'll just go back to this, this chart right here of the, sorry, got lost in my own presentation here. Here we go. So I don't think that this is actually a list of titles which Japanese rights holders and media want to spread abroad. I don't think that that's it at all. I think that it's a list of titles from a larger list of titles that these publishers have decided that they want to boost sales in Japan. And the way they're going to do that is by saying, look, the foreigners love it. But it's kind of interesting in their take on it because they haven't actually even said here that the foreigners love it. They just said the foreigners should love it. So presumably by having more domestic consumption, they can drive it to be more popular abroad. It makes no sense, but it's an effective enough message that Japan's largest newspaper and Japan's largest advertising agency got behind it.
So they're playing on the ignorance of people who live in Japan who haven't traveled to America, I guess.
I don't know if it's so much ignorance as playing on the historic success of using this international image of appeal to drive domestic consumers. It's kind of like a Japanese band that would go take a plane over to, like, Australia, play one show, and then go back to Japan to complete its world tour. The appeal of international, and it's almost like reverse exoticism. In fact, I would call it exoticism, is to say, you know, oh, look, this is all so different. Except they're not saying that they're different. They're saying, hey, look, they think that we're different, and that makes us special. And then as a person who's supposed to be representing that other, I always find it mysterious because I never actually thought those things at all. I mean, I have never thought that a mango represented Japan's appeal abroad. I don't think anyone has ever thought that. But you might think that there would be actors within Japan, perhaps within Miyazaki Prefecture, who would see some benefit by seeing a Japanese television program that's very, very popular say, hey, look, foreigners love mangoes.
About the mango thing, I think another problem is suppose they really believe in mango is something they are proud of to the world.
And they should.
Okay. However, you know, still very equating this local product of mango in a Japanese local place with Japan is the first, you know, overgeneralization. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly Japan is coming into it.
Mm-hmm.
So Japan is always kind of, you know, try to frame, you know, mm-hmm. containing something also within the frame of Japan. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm calling cultural nationalism. Another one is, you know, all the discourse of, you know, Japan, the government or some other, you know, people use their sorry, Japanese in Japanese, Nihon no koyuu no culture, like uniquely Japan, uniquely Japan, something so unique to Japan kind of discourse. But historically, many things, including manga, anime, other things, you know, eventually go back to somewhere outside of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
It's a product of historical interactions
sure.
in modernity.
Right.
the most famous thing, manga artist Tezuka is learned from certain kind of visual, you know.
From Disney in all likelihood, sure.
So anime is clearly so too. So it's very tricky discourse, you know, from the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I mean, it is. I mean, there's arguably you could say that there's no such thing as something that's uniquely Japanese because there's no such thing that's anything unique to any culture at all. Cultures are not billiard balls bouncing against each other. It's just shades of gray, essentially. I mean, and overlapping. Most, I would say most quintessentially Japanese things that Americans might think of when they think of Japan probably have at least in part some foreign origin. I mean, the Japanese script itself uses things that Japanese people themselves call Chinese characters. Clearly, they have international origin. So, I mean, again, this is about image, it's about marketing, it's about branding. It's about how Japan is choosing to frame itself as Japan, saying this is Japanese and this isn't. What I find interesting is that they're trying to frame a dialogue that they don't really have control over. It's to say, this is how the rest of the world sees us, which is not going to be effective when communicated directly to those very actors. It's that Wonder Japan, pamphlet that I put on the screen very briefly that begins by saying, did you know that Japan is having increasing international appeal? That they supposedly wrote specifically to representatives of international missions. I mean, what could they possibly have been thinking trying to tell, say, like, representatives of the American embassy in the U.S., you find this interesting? It couldn't possibly carry any meaning except to be self-referential, to be like, hey, look, we published this proving that foreigners think this. Now we're going to give it to the foreigners. The meaning in the document isn't actually what's written there. It's in publishing it and disseminating it and being able to say that you did it. At least in my opinion. Yes?
Thank you very much for a very informative lecture. It was very good.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for the opportunity. I was very interested in the in sort of like the parallel between when during the Meiji period, you know, Japanese delayed to open up the borders for 10 years, and they studied a lot about foreign culture, and they studied about oil painting, you know, to make a new culture. And then there was a boom in ukiyo-e print, as you say. And then they hired the government, I think hired Ernest Fenollosa, who was an American scholar who was teaching at Tokyo University with Okakura Tenshi Kakuzo. They went throughout the world to determine what Japanese culture should be. So it seems like there's a deep like cultural roots, like, you know, since the time of the Meiji period, and it seems like it's kind of like happening again. And Japanese are always sort of like aware, perhaps, how foreigners were looking at them from outside perspective. And then gradually there's some national art happening. So I thought this kind of like what's happening now and what was happening then were very interesting, like parallels.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that what might make now a little bit different is that it's much easier to bridge the gap. If someone hears, oh, this is what Japan looks like, they can verify it much more easily now. They can go on the internet and look on Google Maps. They can take a flight to Japan much more easily and see it for themselves. So whereas 100 and so many years ago, whatever narrative of Japan that was disseminated could probably be largely controlled, now I don't think that you really can anymore. Because the curators of how Japan should be understood to the world have much less power.
Right.
It's very, very easy for anyone in this audience to say, oh, is this really true? I'm going to look it up on Wikipedia. I'm going to go look it up on Japanese Wikipedia and get it translated automatically on the internet. So it's, I think part of the reason why I'm even able to give a presentation like this is because I can say, hey, look, this is what the message is, but this is what the reality is, and aren't they different? 100 years ago, I don't think it would have been possible to say that because you would have just been advocating another message.
Right, but in a way, like, Japanese were looking at their culture through foreign eyes, like, the original, I think, motivation was really from the World Expo in Vienna, where they sold a lot of Japanese prints, and they... the culture was under the commercial ministry mm-hmm. back then, and I think they thought they can make business out of culture.
Sure, sure.
And then after that, I think Penrosa, how he saw Japanese culture became very important because they didn't know what culture was about.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think at that time, it became under the cultural educational ministry, so mm-hmm. it was a big change, but always like Japanese government was very conscious about how foreigners are looking at their culture.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there's no contents within Japan, but more like presentation
mm-hmm.
is important, and what you are saying is, I think, there's a lot in common between
mm-hmm.
what you were saying
mm-hmm.
back then. Maybe it took a little more time gap, but it seems like the presence of the foreigner in Japan
mm-hmm.
became very important.
Mm-hmm.
The establishment of Japanese culture.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anthony.
That Tokyo poster, I actually saw it in Brooklyn at the end of the city.
Really?
The new Japanese food court / supermarket.
Huh.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Well, like written in Japanese?
Yeah. No. Same exact poster.
Same exact poster.
I saw that poster.
Wow.
So
where do I have it?
It's sort of interesting. Yeah, they used non-Asian on the poster to sort of advertise Japan.
Like to a place which is predominantly, you know, non-Asian.
Well, the people going to the food court were
here we go.
Sort of mixed, but mostly Asian, yes. But it's within a facility that used to be sort of like warehouses,
mm-hmm.
and then they're converting them right now
uh-huh.
to offices and shopping areas.
Uh-huh.
So I saw that.
Huh. Wow, thank you for telling me.
Hokusai,
yeah.
Uniqlo recently, they released a new batch of t-shirts,
uh-huh.
and there's one batch is targeted towards craft beer.
I mean, it's as universally appealing of a motif as you're going to get. I'm glad that they're putting it on, you know, the equivalent of the $10 bill.
Well, that's the funny thing, you say it's universal. So I was with an older gentleman, right?
Uh-huh.
My coworker, we went there to
uh-huh.
shop, and he saw a particular design that he liked.
Uh-huh.
And when I showed him Hokusai, he said, that's too stereotypical.
What? How do you get something that's like close to being universally appealing that isn't stereotypical?
Well, I mean that particular image, as you said, appears on so many things.
Yeah.
To him, that's too normal, so he wanted a different type of t-shirt.
No, that will be fun feedback to give to my friends within the government. You know, give me something that's less normal.
I mean, and then in regards to the Dory Bond.
Uh huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
The blue robot cat. How'd they do?
Didn't do too well.
They kind of went away pretty fast, though, too, I think.
It's so quickly.
Oh, okay. That's probably good.
It was like
did you have your hand up?
Yeah. I was going to say, that event you said you went to with the international, it was four people who are international, but you and another guy were the only ones there from...
Yeah. The Sugoi Japan Award.
I was wondering, picked on them. I was wondering, maybe if they did invite people who are from other countries,
uh-huh.
it would not allow them to do this.
Oh, yeah.
And then also, but to confirm my suspicion, do they promote tourism outside of Japan to the Japanese people? Like, oh, go to America, go check out what America is like, go to Europe, go to...
Does the Japanese government do that?
Like here, like, is the in America, they're always telling us to go to some foreign place.
They are?
On vacation. Yeah, you go on a subway, you go on outside, it's like go to Aruba, Barbados, Caribbean Islands or something.
Is it the American establishment doing it, or is it representatives of the foreign tourism associations who are doing it?
I see. There's always a lot of ads to travel here.
I mean, like, I've definitely seen ads in Japan about, hey, you should study abroad in America, but those tend to be sponsored and produced by agencies related to the American embassy. So it's not like the Japanese government, I don't think they're the primary like driving force behind, you know, hey, go and study in America. The American government has a little office called UNESCO. No, not UNESCO. The U.S.-Japan Educational Community, JUSEC, Japan-U.S. Educational Commission. It's in kind of downtown Tokyo, and they have a little library of study abroad resources, guides, computers there for Japanese people to come and do research on where they might want to study abroad. But I believe it is fully funded and supported by the American government.
So they're not promoting traveling outside?
I mean, would the Japanese government do that? I think there's probably some context in which it would, but my guess is that it's the foreign government's actually doing it. I don't know. The gentleman in the back is shaking his head. Do you know?
You're right.
Okay.
It's
good.
Foreign government promoting.
Japan government is not saying to go travel outside.
So I mean, it'd be nice if they would.
So then it makes sense that they're bringing outside things to promote, to say, hey, America's like this. Don't go to America, but we're going to tell you what America's like, so you can stay here.
I don't think anyone is specifically saying, hey, don't go there, don't verify the messages that we're saying.
Directly.
I mean, are they doing it by omission? I think that it's convenient that it's not there, but I'm not sure that it's necessarily like on purpose and by design. I don't think that the folks who design this as a marketing initiative, which is essentially what it is, are doing it with the sole purpose, the primary purpose of trying to like co-opt the foreign view. It's just what's convenient. I mean, no one is doing this for like malicious or like nefarious intent.
Not malicious, nefarious, but just that, yeah, like you said, it's convenient.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're looking for economic results that are domestic. There's nothing inherently bad about that.
No.
Using international appeal as a foil to get more people to buy more Japanese things, I think if it works, it's great. It's just that when you try to use that as a way to get non-Japanese to buy things, it's probably not going to be all that efficient. I mean, like showing this and saying, hey, look, Japanese fans think that you should buy Attack on Titan. How about that? It's not going to drive you to buy this comic. It'd be far more effective to be like, hey, look, this is really successful in America. Maybe Americans like it. You're American too, right? Even that, though, I think is not as effective as saying this is what's good about the manga inherently. But that's not what they chose to do. CJ?
Sorry. Just one more comment. I'm asking to my students, you know, when they encounter the Japanese popular culture, when I teach in the popular culture course, then they say certain kind of, you know, Pokemon or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like a Pokemon anime or, you know, video game, whatever. But another question about that experience, if they knew it from Japan,
mm-hmm.
then they say, you know, not always so, right? So they are accessing to the Japanese popular culture, however, without knowing it,
mm-hmm.
when they were so young.
Mm-hmm.
So, which means that even just like this kind of discourse in Cool Japan, they found that is from Japan, or association with Japan, or connection
mm-hmm.
with Japan, much, much later. So
mm-hmm.
they discovered,
right.
So I think it's kind of very interesting, weird tension there too, because appeal is not so much, you know, originally not so much related to Japan,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't matter to the audience outside of Japan, but still, you know, later, you know, retroactively kind of connecting
mm-hmm.
with Japan, so kind of, including your personal experience, it's kind of
sure.
interesting. You know? All the kind of weird attention on that. People are talking about the same thing, but the seeing totally different.
Entirely different. I mean, even when someone says the words Cool Japan, as someone who, you know, is supposedly an expert on the phenomenon, I still don't know exactly what they're talking about until they qualify it. They could be talking about the government, they could be talking about the brand, they could be talking about the phenomenon. It's impossible to tell. But people will carry on conversations regardless, even though I don't think it's actually clear to anyone specifically what they're saying. And maybe that's the point. It's just about engaging people about this idea without actually going into the details. I mean, that's fine, too. Plenty of marketing works that way.
Nobody says that, but eventually, Cool America is, throughout the post of Japan, it's circulating. Nobody mentioned that word. But the Japanese cultural product is everywhere, right? Impossible Japan, or even some other areas too.
I mean, it is interesting that the name of Cool Japan itself is like self-qualifying, right? You might think that it would be more effective to simply let it hang in the context or the subtext of it, but they chose the name Cool Japan. What's interesting is that many representatives of the program, who are much more representative of it than I do, will often open speeches representing the government program itself by saying, I'm not entirely comfortable with the name Cool Japan. Minister Hirai, who heads up Cool Japan strategy, is the top political figure in the entire conglomerate, often opens his speeches by saying, I'm the Cool Japan administrator, but I don't really like the name Cool Japan. Which kind of begs the question, if you're the minister, why don't you change it? But it's probably not that easy. It's probably not that practical. And I guess, at least within a Japanese sphere, there's some utility to putting out an initial comment saying, I understand that I probably shouldn't be complimenting myself here. I think it might be a little bit more effective if they just didn't do it in the first place, but maybe it's not.